White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretics Hour on February 25th, 2013. I am Carolyn Yeager, and tonight I have my very special guest for our third episode of doing a show together, and that's Tan Stoffel. Welcome, Tan Stoffel.
Thanks, Carolyn. Hi. It's our third time. It's three quarters of a year now since we started this.
Right. I should remember that, but as soon as I start to say something, no, wait a minute, is this a third or the fourth or the what? So anyway, this is great to have you. I always like to have you on, and we do enjoy doing programs together. So I didn't call this program tonight the Progress Report, because as I had, you know, when we started out doing them, but because I didn't think that we were dealing with progress anymore. Not that we're not progressing, but it's not our focus as well. What kind of progress have we made? Because we're kind of set, you know, and established. And so we're going to talk about that. I didn't know whether we should start with that or not, because we're also going to talk about identity and who is our enemy. I mean, anonymity, excuse me. Folks, I lost all my notes shortly before the show started when I had to close down my reboot my computer. I was having a lot of problems with it, and this something was wrong with the way this notes page, and it just got wouldn't come up again. So I don't have them. I've been trying to kind of reconstruct. So, but we're gonna still be able to cover all these same topics. In fact, I need to bring that other page up to remind me what we were gonna cover. So, but if I sound a little schizophrenic right now, that's the reason. So as we talk about the White Network in conjunction with what we wanted to do when we started, we can ask the question, because I think I'm going to title this show "How Do You Measure Success?" Because we're going to measure our success here. According to how we would measure it, right? So how do we measure that, Tan?
Well, you know, my goal, as I said at the beginning, was to enable you to continue doing the radio that you had been doing at VOR. And I enjoyed your work so much, and you convinced me to begin a program of my own, and I've enjoyed that very much. And so by that, those two measures, I think, it's been very successful. I'm happy with what we've done. We can always do more, and we're going to talk a bit about what we're going to do in the future. I think it's pretty good. I'm very happy.
Yeah, I am too. You know, I'm at first, you know, as I had said in other programs, I thought, well, we were going to have to grow and get a lot of shows and so on. But after experiencing some of that, and you reminded me, it was Dietrich that said when he was on, well, wait till you, start in having other hosts, and then you'll see what kind of trouble you run into. And that was the problem that he said he had,
VOR, Voice of Reason.
Voice of Reason. Yeah, which still hasn't come back. And, you know, I always wonder whether to bring that up or not, you know, or just
well,
let
you just
that
did.
Play. I just did. And, you know, it's kind of sad that was never able to get going again. And boy, there's a lot to say about what kind of weakness was there that it couldn't do it. But I really don't know that there's any reason to talk about that. But there you go, is that, the listeners lost Voice of Reason Radio, which had a lot of shows. And they gained the White Network, which only has a few. But we think that we offer quite a bit. I don't think people should be listening to radio programs 24 hours a day. So if there were great programs on all the time, you know, it would be kind of hard for them to pick and choose or to spend that much time listening. And there are a lot of other programs and networks. There's not too many that I think too much of, but there's some that I do think well of. And so I think there's plenty for people to listen to. And we have decided, have we not, or at least we're satisfied that we want to have a very particular message. And it's not that many people who want to be limited to that particular message. And so it's not likely that we're going to have a happy relationship with that many people. And there's not too many people also who are willing to put in the time and effort to do radio programs, even one a week. So, or even one every 2 weeks, truthfully. So people have actually suggested that why doesn't Hadding Scott do a program, as if I'm not, you know, asking him or not allowing him to or whatever, but Hadding is not prepared to be on that kind of a schedule where he has to come up with something regularly like that, other than the International Jew. So that's the answer to that. And so I'm really satisfied because, for one thing, I have so much work to do, and I have other things besides the radio programs I want to do. And really in conjunction with them, in order to reinforce some of the ideas that I present in the radio programs. So I don't want more on my plate. And even if we had other hosts, yeah, they'd be doing their own show. But then what we found is that there's a lot of time having to be put in to their shows, too. And again, as I say, since we have a particular kind of message on the White Network, you know, you can't let hosts just go, you know, have hosts just going anywhere and everywhere. So we're kind of, we're probably not going to have much of a bigger menu unless it might be one show added or something. The last one that we had coming along just died out, you know. It just died for no reason that I know of, except that the person found they just didn't, I don't know, maybe some changes in their life. But I was never able to get a final answer to that. Last I know, he was still working on it, but never showed up with anything. So that's how it goes with people. So, you know, there are, and if I might have had a little feeling of, well, I didn't want other networks to forge ahead and we were not, you know, thinking of ourselves as a network. But I've gotten over that too, because I don't mind if other groups get on and want to have something, you know, 24 hours a day or something like that, you know, want to have millions of, you know, bunches of shows all the time. I don't mind that either. Now, you know, it doesn't bother me one little bit. I'm quite satisfied with my niche here, and that I am able to do what I want to do. That's one great thing, that we don't have any, you know, we get along fine, and we agree on our philosophy. And so let's go into that just a little bit again, you know, because I have heard listening. I do try to listen now and then to different shows. I mean, some shows I kind of often listen to, and some I rarely do. But I have heard just here and there a little bit of, well, if not direct criticism, like, you know, that I don't, not, maybe not even mentioning the White Network, but, you know, those who want to be, you know, not allow anything but white people. That's, you know, I mean, that's kind of narrow. And if you can't even talk to people who aren't white, or you don't, you know, want to listen to them, or you don't want to hear what they have to say, that's too narrow. our idea is that we want white people to be able to have a place where there's just white people, and we don't have to be having. And then this fits in with the online anonymity, too. We don't have people who are joining the conversation and don't really have the interests of whites foremost in mind. They might partly, but not totally. And, you know, we just don't want that going on. We want this special special place. And so would you comment on that, please?
Sure. Well, the most important thing is the identity part, and that has really crystallized in my mind in the work that we've done, and just right from the get-go in trying to think of what the goal was and what our mission statement, you know, how we would describe ourselves, crystallized in my mind what we were trying to do and why we're trying to do it. And it starts with who is us. You can't sensibly discuss or debate anything really until you decide who are you advocating, whose interests are you advocating in favor of? Who is us? So you can't talk about that stuff sensibly, and much of the conversation going on in the mainstream media having to do with politics is a bunch of people who have lost sight of that. They're arguing with other people that don't share their interests, don't share their most common fundamental elements of identity about who they are and what's best for us. And so they just – it's a big food fight. And that food fight is avoided, or at least a large part of it is avoided, if you can agree we're white people, we're talking about what's good for white people. And you can argue about who's white and who isn't and what does it mean and before you even get into what's best for white people. And then you can argue a lot about that. But at least you're not going to be going off in these long digressions about whether it's good or bad for black people or whether it's good or bad for Jews and other people.
Well, so. Yeah, and you know, you as you started your program, I can't even remember your very first ones. I should have looked back at them. But you know, you're talking about interesting things, but then you got into this history of or kind of the back going way back to how the races, you know, actually the origin of whites and, you know, the migrations and,
right.
You know, where they
first,
came from.
First
so
principles
on.
Of identity, yeah. And first principles of race, yeah.
Yeah, and that has led you to all these programs since that are really interesting, where you're just delving into this whole question of who we are and why we're not other people, why they're
That's
not right.
us. Why it makes sense to think the way we do. I mean, a lot of people just come to this conclusion about advocating for white and thinking of themselves as white intuitively, and I did too. In fact, I came to that even before I saw very clearly understood the relationship of the Jews to my identity, and I came to white first. And what I've discovered in delving through this stuff, you know, the first month or 2 months of the programs that I did was really just a review of some of the things that I had discovered, the pretty stones that I had uncovered and crystallized previously. But then I started to get in, as you noticed, the character of the show changed as I started to delve into stuff that I hadn't yet covered. And I was learning myself. And in fact, my blog is like this. My radio program is just an extension of it. It's a learning process. It's sort of like an open journal where I'm sharing what I discover you know, with sources and quotations, the things that have an impact on my thinking, I want to share with other people because I don't have any illusions that I'm going to change everybody's mind. And I don't, you know, I'm not going to change black people's mind. I'm not even aiming at them. I don't have any illusions about changing every white person's mind either. But there are other white people like myself who I can appeal to, and that's who I'm trying to appeal to.
You know, speaking about that, because I was going to say, well, you know, there are people who disagree, white people who disagree with this kind of thinking that we want to just be white, or that, you know, in white nationalism we wouldn't be accepting some people who weren't white, or or we would be working, you know, allying with non-whites and so on, and all of this. Big, I guess you'd call it the big tent thing, and we don't go along with the big tent idea simply because we think that we have a message that is that there are people who are ready to receive it, and that really is who we're talking to, and we're not trying to talk to everybody. We've said that many times. How much? I know you. I don't know what you're going to say, so I'm going to ask you. How would you value the different philosophies here? Do you think the Big Ten? I mean, would you think that the Big Ten approach could be just as successful as the specific approach that you take? Or
well, It's out of my realm of specialty. I don't really focus on the political strategy, and I haven't. That's not to say I won't someday. But generally, I think in conversations with you and listening to what you and Hadding have had to say about it, that I tend to be bigger tent than both of you in you know, broader appealing to a broader group of people, maybe being more tolerant of certain things rather than things needing or people needing to think a certain thing other beyond the whiteness aspect and the Jews aren't white. But I think what you're getting at is these other sort of peripheral related spheres of thinking, the truth movement and the thing that I came up through, this counter jihad, the patriotard, Alex Jones, these other things that aren't racialist organizations, aren't racialist thinking spheres, but they have a lot of people in them that are thinking along similar lines to us, and maybe even would be willing to see the same enemies as us. And when it comes to that, I am also fairly tolerant. I mean, I don't. I've heard your interviews with Alex Linder, and I think Alex Linder is very intelligent. I agree with almost everything he says, but as when it comes to the style of the way he wants to go about it, his strategy of attacking conservatives, that doesn't appeal to me. I don't do that. I don't think he's necessarily wrong at that. And you and I have talked about, and I know you're critical of, this idea of let everybody do their own thing, that we should decide what the right thing is to do, and then all of us do it in concert. And I agree with that.
Yeah, well, when I say that, of course, I don't mean everybody. I mean that there should be a group of people who can do this and who do work together. And you know, as big a group as you can have, but it's not going to be that big.
Yeah.
Because never going to be everybody. Yeah.
I don't mean to sound wishy-washy like I'm giving an answer that pleases everyone, but how to put it? It's a good point, the idea of arguing about what the best thing is to do. I'm all for, you know, trying to solve the problem. In fact, that's why this policy of constraining ourselves to a conversation amongst white people about what's best for white people, the whole idea there is to remove the obstacles and the constant clutter and the constant derailing that happens when you don't limit things to that premise to begin with. So I'm all for that, because you can't solve problems until you can identify what the problems are, and you can't solve the problems if you can't talk about or argue about them. And, you know, there's another side to that, which is, well, we could argue forever. And obviously, I don't want to argue forever. But, my approach or my idea of being more tolerant of other people doing their own thing is in the vein of we should try as many things as we can. I know we have relatively limited resources of people who are thinking along the right lines, thinking along lines similar to ours, racialist lines and white identity. But all of these other people out there, all the Alex Jones types and the truthers, are working away, and we don't have to do anything for them to be working away. And some of them, especially if they hear peripherally somehow the kind of things that we're talking about, will eventually see the light. We should definitely try to get them to see the light. That's how I feel about that big tent idea. But I don't think think we should compromise in order to make a big tent. I don't think that deception about your political views and your political goals works in the long term. And in that respect, I agree a lot of what Hadding has to say is very appealing to me. That and it's summed up in the adage, you know, you can't sneak up on the Jews. The Jews are far too sensitive. And they're going to sniff you out. You can't pretend that you're talking about liberals when you really mean the Jews. Just talk about the Jews. It's right there. What they do is largely out in the open. So we can point right to it and say it's the Jews.
Yeah, well, you know, we along with who is us, we need to be asking who is our enemy, because we have to know our enemy, and we have to name our enemy. And that's what you're saying here.
Yeah. You can't know your enemy until you know who you are.
And yet there's so many don't see the enemy in as across the board. You know, they don't want to make others their enemy. They only want to look, and they want to look for the people who they think are holding us down or holding us back or against us. But that includes a whole lot of white people.
Sure.
So then get out of the white and non-white classification and go into some other kind of classification.
Yeah, but that's bad thinking on their part. I think to use an example here that's already come up, the left and the right, if you consider yourself and you identify as a conservative, as a Republican, as a right winger, then you interpret your enemy to be the left wing. And sometimes it's even a mirage. You just think if somebody's attacking you, oh, it's because they're a liberal. You misunderstand the reality of the situation because it's not always a liberal who's attacking you. Whereas if you see it in racial terms, the fact that some of our enemies are white people doesn't invalidate racial identity. It just means those people are traitors. That's the right way to see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So it's a racial thing. If it's racial, then we have to say that we are that all white people are us, and all non-white people are not us.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean we don't have white enemies.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean that people like John McCain aren't our enemy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And that's why it gets confusing. And why people, you know, don't like this particular way of looking at it sometimes so strictly, because there are so many exceptions that you have to take into account. Well, what about the idea that...
idea. They're just looking for a rationalization because they don't want to think about race. And, you know, they're incentivized. Everybody is indoctrinated that, you know, if you're white especially, race is a bad thing to think about. You shouldn't think about things in terms of race. And so they're always looking for excuses not to think about race. But that same complaint, you know, that, John McCain is a bad white guy and therefore race is invalid, or being white is an invalid identity. There's traitors amongst Democrats and Republicans, too. There's people who switch sides back and forth. It's a criticism that applies just as much to any other identity. The fact about the racial identity is there's a biological basis for it. You know, whereas as well as an ideological basis, but the biological is rooted in nature, in an immutable set of genes. And with these other ideologies that are purely ideological, they're much easier to change. They're much easier to shift. They're much easier to create and manipulate people by imagining things that they should be loyal to, rather than these biologically rooted identities, which are much more concrete.
Well, I think that that we start with the racial division and racial loyalty, and then we do though have to recognize that the ideology comes in, and many of our racial brethren are of a take on a different ideology, which makes them, which is anti-racist, you know, anti-racial. And that's the most difficult one, when they're that. So then you can't consider them, allies or comrades at all, or even in the same, group.
Well, it doesn't invalidate the racial way of looking at it. It's bad for our race that there are people in our race, in our group, that have taken on that attitude. I think a lot of them, especially the light flavor, are mistaken. They're under a wrong impression. They're thinking incorrectly, and their ideology can be changed. Their ideas can be changed, and that's why it's important to, you know, fight the bad ideas and point out where they're wrong. But there are true believers, too. There are people who have decided very rationally that this is the best way for them personally, or their family, or their bloodline, or however they're thinking about it, mostly for their pocketbook, and that's why they do what they do. And they have thought about it. It's not that they didn't think too deeply about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Well, how does this, you know, I should mention, I failed to do that in the beginning, because there might be people who are not familiar with your blog. And it is ageoftreason.blogspot.com. And is there is a hyphen between Age of Treason, right?
Right. All three words have hyphens. Yeah. But if you just Google Age of Treason or search should find my blog.
Yeah, for a while you were not having time to do much on that, but you've caught up again. You've had a lot of very interesting.
I'm interested there. I've gotten some time, you know, around the holidays. It gets very busy for my the work I do for an income, and so I don't have as much time to blog. And before that, it was the new load of doing the network stuff that slowed me down. But yeah, I think I've hit a stride now, a manageable discipline of what I can accomplish in a week. I try to get the show, one program done, and at least one substantial blog post.
Yeah, well, that's good, because we all missed you on your blog when you weren't putting too much on there. Well, that brings us to anonymity, I think, talking about you and your blog. And you have been, as we said earlier, you know, there's different kinds of internet anonymity. You know, there's the light kind, and there's the real deep anonymity. And you have used a pseudonym for a long time. Most people don't have any idea what your real name is, which is probably a good thing for you, because, as you said, you have a work that you do for an income. And people who have to do that, I think they should, I don't see anything wrong with that. And when I have made any criticism of anonymity, it was only to people who were posting a lot with, not the most well thought out things, and kind of aggressively, and just without anybody having any idea who they are, what they are, where they come from, or anything, you know, with strange kind of names that they can change at will. So, you know, that to me is where a part of the problem lies, but I don't even care too much about that if they're not allowed to take over comment boards and so on, and forums of places. That has to do with the person that's managing it. But there was this, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, and it may be that they can even force people. I can't imagine how they would do it. Force people to use their real name on the internet. You sent me an article that is just a kind of a opening of this issue. You want to talk
just
about
open
that
up.
For a minute?
Sure. There was a recent bill proposed in Illinois by a state senator whose name is Ira Silverstein, of course. Called the Internet Posting Removal Act. It has to do with people who post anonymous comments would have to reveal their identity, their home address, their IP address, things like that. And it's about holding people accountable for what they have to say. In fact, it's very much in line with what Andre Anglin, the point he made, which, you know, I'm sensitive to this issue, criticism of people who write anonymously, because I write pseudo-anonymously. You've made the distinction between the people who are purely anonymous and just pick a different name every time, or just pick anonymous every time, and people like me who write under a pseudonym for a length of time and have some personality or stand that's attached to my name, even though it has shifted over time. So I have a couple of things to say about that. One is, you know, apparently this Jew thinks that it's in the best interests of Jews that people who are making anonymous comments on, and I think he's mainly thinking of anonymous forums, 4chan type places, and other message boards and news sites, especially, where you can see that people are starting to think along lines similar to ours. They're starting to question the regime, and a lot of it is happening anonymously, because a lot of these people have, like me, they have paying jobs that would probably find cause to fire them if the boss of that person, or whoever's paying their paycheck, were to find out, if they work for the government or whatever, would fire them if they knew what their opinions were. And yet it's good for us that these opinions are expressed, because it lets people know that there are other people who are thinking along similar lines. It's it's good for us psychologically to know. It helps to know that there are other people or other sane people out there who see the same thing you do and who think about it in the same terms you do. And what this Jewish state senator wants to do is basically squelch it, because he knows that by forcing everybody to attach their name and address to everything, a lot of it will be squelched. Now, it will polarize, basically. Some people, and I'm guessing probably most of them, will just shut up now and will stop commenting.
How would you attach your name and address? I don't get that.
Well, the website, they'd probably have to – it would probably – the technology of it would be you'd have to register for Facebook. They're doing this too in other moves, making you log on with your Facebook identity. And then they want to make your Facebook identity be attached to your real identity, so that you have to provide Facebook with your name and address. It wouldn't necessarily be accessible by everyone on the Internet, but it would make the authorities – like the SPLC and the NEL, it would make it easier for them to get your information. Although I agree with the point Andre made a couple of shows ago when you had him on, that if those kind of organizations, especially the intelligence organizations, the ones that actually have police power, if they want to know who you are, they're going to find out who you are. They can find out who you are. They probably already know who I am. But I'm not a big enough fish to do anything to. And I agree also with that point. In fact, I agree a lot with what Andre had to say. I think the only thing I would take issue with, at least in my own personal case, is he said that, you know, people who write anonymously, they must not care very much about what they have to say. And I do care about what I have to say. I think the reason, and I do struggle with this issue about whether to just say to the world who I am, reveal myself, and take on, you know, whatever they're going to dole out. And for that reason of, you know, I should prove that I really believe what I say. But I have to say, as I did in the first program that I did, you wouldn't recognize my name. You might as well imagine my name is Joe Sixpack, because that's what my name, my real name, would mean to anyone who's listening to this. I haven't done anything famous. I haven't done anything that you would have heard of. And in fact, it's a pretty plain name, so it would be hard to Google me even, because there would be so many hits of other people who aren't me. But I do understand why people want to know. They want to see, who is this guy? Who does he think he is? Is he even white? Is he hiding something? And that's partly why I disclosed my wife's situation, that my wife's father was Jewish. Because it's important. It's important to me when I criticize people who are writing articles that I agree with or disagree with, I look into who they are. I want to know, who's the Jews? And a lot of times you'll find Jews behind it. And if you find a Jewish person, very often you look at their face, and a lot of times you can see just by their face that they're Jewish. And I often post, along with my blog post, when I'm criticizing somebody who's written something or done something, I put their face right up on there. And it's a little bit of an asymmetry there, but I don't feel guilty about that so much. I'm acknowledging that other people would love to be able to do that to me and put my face up on something and say, look at this nasty neo-Nazi racist hater, and put some bad picture of me up. So I don't really want to help them do that. You know, it's about not making it easy for my enemies. And I have to say, I am afraid of what would happen to me and what could be done to me. Although I do see that there are people who operate under their real names, and actually, they are harmed. They do suffer for it, and I have nothing but respect for those people, which is why I'm torn on this.
Well, I wouldn't be if I were you, as I've said before. I think you have a situation that justifies you using this pseudonym, and I don't understand why anybody would agree that nobody on the Internet can be anonymous, that everybody has to attach them. What do they care? I mean, how could they make a case of that? I don't even understand that.
Well, they want to hold people accountable. What they really intend
for talking against the Jews, that's what.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what Ira Silverstein wants.
Yeah, and Holocaust denial and stuff like that. Right.
He wants to punish them. Right. He wants to haul them into court. He wants to sue them out of existence. He wants to punish. That's the purpose, yeah.
Exactly.
He wants to know who his enemies are so he can destroy them.
Yeah, and when we're talking about it, when we were talking about, say, on Total Fascism site and things like that, it's not for that reason at all. It, you know, it's not to make everybody make themselves known and stuff. There was a totally different reason for it, which was just to stop people from being so irresponsible in their silly hateful posts and so on.
Yeah,
and I suppose the Jews can see it that way too, and the government too, that people like us are irresponsible in what we're doing, and we should have to be held accountable for it.
We have an advantage here in that we are anonymous, and it makes it harder for them to find us and squash us or hurt us. And that's why they need laws forcing us to be out in the open and forcing us to attach our names and identities to things.
Yeah.
Whereas they're in charge of the regime that's in power right now. They operate under their real name. And it's easy for us to know who our enemies are. They sign their names on the bottoms of their bylines in every article that they write. Every time Alan Dershowitz goes anywhere, it's under his name. Or anytime Ira Silverstein does. So, you know, we have a bit of an advantage in that. We know who our enemies are. We can look them up. For us, when we want to know who's speaking, it's because we want to know, should we pay attention to what this person is saying? And part of my argument when I have defended this issue about being pseudonymous in the past is, well, my ideas speak for themselves. And if, you know, you need to know who I am to care about whether my ideas make sense or not, well, that's not very good. But then again, I do understand that people who whiteness is important to, or racial identity, they want to know that I'm not a Jew. And that's where it hurts me that, and I disclosed it anyway, to say that my wife's father was Jewish. And because that immediately puts a big question mark over anybody who's reading my stuff. They're saying, okay, so how is he going to excuse the Jews here? How is he trying to win himself and his family a place in a Jew-free white ethnostate? And the answer to that is, I'm not. I've said very explicitly that that's not my goal. I'm not trying to lead this organization. I'm not trying to form an organization. You know, at best you could say I'm trying to advise. I'm trying to educate. And mainly I'm trying to educate myself. But I want to share that and my best interests. And this is the nature of nationalism over individualism is, you know, I try to set aside my own selfish interests, my own family's interests even, because I do care about a larger group. I care about my race. I want, and the more I learn about it, the more I care. The more I want it to continue, even if I can't.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I know. And now back to this anonymity. Most people in the white community or white movement or whatever who have, I don't know if you call them leading roles or whatever, whether they're intellectuals and they've, you know, from someone like Kevin MacDonald to someone like Mike Delaney, who's, you know, got websites and, you know, but, you know, and anything in between there, you've got, most of these people do use their names.
I think it's natural. When people come forward and want to lead, their name comes out. They have to put their name out there
because
that's part of what qualifies them is that they're willing to put themselves out there. And in order to lead, they have to do that.
Yeah, right. So I think that nobody is trying to get rid of anonymity except our enemies. They're the ones that want to get rid of anonymity.
Well, no, altogether. Both Andre Englund makes a good point, and Alex Linder has made a similar point. And on his forum, you have to use a real sounding name. You know, no Tanstoffel like names on his forum. And he'd prefer. He's said several times.
Is that right? It seems like there are some weird names on his forum.
There
Maybe
are.
Not.
They just have to sound real. And but if for when it comes to politics, he makes the valid point. You know, we need to operate under our real names out in the real world. And that's a valid point.
Well, we do in the sense that what to encourage that is good for those who are, you know, can do it. It's good because, the more people who are espousing these ideas and saying, you know, I'm so and so, I'm a real person, the better.
Yeah.
Than just people who are not.
I can at least say that I'm a real person. And in fact, I've met other real people in the racialist movement. You know, I've gone to some meetings and met other people. And it is very good for morale to meet other people face to face. It's very good to shake hands with somebody and put a face and even a name to those people when you meet them. And I'm all for that, and I will do more of that. I'm sure I will. And So, you know, I'm not trying to hide who I am from my allies, from people on our side. I'm really just kind of cowardly about what the enemy.
Well, I wouldn't use that word. You just don't want it to get in the hands of your.
I'm just trying to be blunt.
The people you work for and stuff like that. You know.
Yeah, I'm not going to defend myself by trying to say that what I'm doing is noble or great. It's not. And I'm. Anyway.
Yeah. Well,
who was it you just mentioned? Mike Delaney. I just want to set the record straight because the last time we had a status show, a program, Mike Delaney came up because you were talking about the statistics that he was quoting, mm-hmm. His traffic statistics. And I had made some impudent remark about how he used the euphemism Zionists when he was referring to Jews. And I was mildly critical of that. I said, you know, we shouldn't do that. We should just call them Jews. That's what they call themselves. Well, the interview you did with Mike Delaney, he was great. And I could see that I was very wrong about that. I didn't know much about what he had done. And the whole rat-faced Jews thing, I mean, there's a guy, he's not afraid to call Jews Jews. He'll call them rat-faced Jews. And so that's that was
actually... You know, I just found out that that rat-faced Jews just went offline.
Oh, really?
And it says it was canceled or something like that. I forget now what it said on there. So I don't think it's just maintenance or whatever. I think it's no longer there. I don't know the reason for it, but maybe it wasn't. He didn't think it was too important anymore. Or maybe somebody got it taken down. So, but that's kind of new. So I can't say. But people can find this article about the online anonymity with this Silverstein wants to get passed in the Illinois legislature at the Daily Caller under Illinois State Senator pushes anti-anonymity bill if they want to read that.
Yeah. And it's just part of a larger effort. Like I said, they want to get people to sign up with Facebook with their real name and Twitter accounts and, you know, similar things. They want to strip away anonymity. And it's because it's hurting them, because all of these people making impudent remarks about the Jews online, and they're emboldened in part by the fact that they can do it anonymously. It's a bit of an illusion, as I said. If you really say something inflammatory, and the security agencies want to know who you are, they can find out who you are even now. So people are really kind of deluding themselves, thinking that just because they sign anonymously or don't log in, that they're not known.
You know, this is why it's so important for us to really fight, really get into the fight and think in, you know, I think in terms of that we're in a war. I mean, I think we have to realize we're in a war. And when you have these people who are trying to come up with everything they can think of legally to stop you from opposing them, which is the Jewish control of this, you know, the Jewish controllers of the whole world practically, through their financial power, but in the United States through all kinds of power, you know, when you see what they're trying to do, we cannot just stand by, because pretty soon we won't have any voice to be able to open our mouth. You know, I can't think of a worse way to live. Makes me glad that I'm not young, truthfully, when I think about it, because it would be so depressing to me to think that it could be possible that I would end up in a society, or the society could end up, and it's very close to it, where I couldn't, like in Germany, where, you know, where you can't speak against, you can't speak against the Jews or anything else, or the left wingers or anything. You can't speak in terms of right wing thinking. You know, people are afraid, and I just would hate to be in that position and know who was enforcing it on me, you know, and have to accept it. I can't think of anything worse. So we have to understand that we are in a war, even if it's not for our life, it's going to be for our future, it will be for our future existence, even if it's not our existence right this minute. We're not going to be killed, but we're going to, you know, we're going to be destroyed in our spirit, and so we have to come out and fight with everything. And this is where I think that it is better, and I've said this many times, but it is better to be very aggressive in this than it is to be try to be polite or not, you know, upset anybody, or particularly this argument that most white people are don't like, you know, aggressive talk against the Jews, so it's better not to do it. I think that's just baloney. I think we have to be very aggressive and point out what the Jews are really like and what they're really about. And I think more and more people, when they see people doing this and see it, you know, growing even a little, or see people being bolder about it, will agree with it, and they will also they will move along in that direction. And we have to move in that direction, would you say? I mean, we don't have a choice.
It's existential. That's the struggle. And I do use the word war. I don't use it all the time because, you know, it's like the word genocide. You get people going, oh, but there aren't really people being hacked to death with machetes, so it can't be genocide. You know, that kind of weak thinking. I mean, it is a war. It's a racial, ethnic war against white people, against all white people as a whole, and against individual white nations. And that's clear, and it's existential, as you say. And you know, they're coming for the speech. They are taking the principles that have you know, that were formed hundreds of years ago, agreed upon by white people, that there would be freedom of association is already gone. Freedom of speech is under attack. Freedom of arms is also under attack. And, you know, if you can't say that it's Ira Silverstein who wants to take away your freedom of speech, and it's Chuck Schumer and Dianne Feinstein who want to take away your guns, how can you prevent it from happening? By pretending it's liberals that want to take that stuff away? That doesn't even make any sense. You know, these liberals, you know, the whole idea being liberty, are impinging on your freedom. It's enough to make you just shut up, because it's so stupid. It's such a stupid idea. And the idea that it's just who it is, that you simply identify who these people are and why, because they recognize that it's an existential thing. They're pretty clear on that. That makes a lot more sense. And at least for people who think the way I do, and as I say, for it, that's all I'm really, my ambition is to appeal to, is people who think like myself or can think like myself, is speaking reason to them, giving them an explanation that makes more sense than this senseless explanation that they see in the mainstream. That makes something click in their head. And once that clicks in their head, you don't have to really lecture them too much about pointing things out. They'll be finding those things themselves. What I've done with friends and family is point out the Jewish involvement in media, on television and in the news. And for instance, they'll say, oh, but Fox News is good. You say, well, look at all the Jews on Fox News. Pay attention sometime. And that's all you have to say. And then they come back a month later and they go, you know what? I can't watch Fox News anymore. And they've done the work themselves. But they did need a help. Some help. They needed a helping hand. They needed a bit of a push to see, make them see it. But then they do see it, and then they start. You know, before I know it, I'm getting links from them in the mail about things that I otherwise wouldn't have seen. So
that's very good.
This is what we need to do on a larger scale.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, we've got about 10 minutes to the break. And we were going to talk about what happened to Charles Kraft, and then we had a couple other things. But we also had this article, this editorial recently written by Bill Fink, and I think maybe that we could actually segue into any of these things from where we're at now. But maybe we'll segue into that, into this one, and then go into the other after the break. So he did this. I thought it was an excellent editorial he wrote for his Saxon Messenger. This is Bill Fink of Christa Guinea. And I know there's also been a lot of controversy lately over the Christian identity and trying to push itself into white nationalism and take over, and the anti-Christians, too, who hate Christian identity especially, and all this stuff. But I like Bill Fink. He's He's a friend of mine, and he's always been a real good guy. And I sent you this editorial, and you liked it too.
Yeah.
And particularly, but I had some parts of it taken out in my notes, but that's gone now. So, but particularly, I thought the last paragraph, or maybe it was the last two paragraphs, that were good. How the second to the last paragraph. I'll just read this, and then you can say what you want to say.
Sure.
Furthermore, he said he ends up, whites must have clear ideals. Well, actually, the title of this was racial. What? No, I don't have the title here.
The racist right.
The racist right. Okay, thank you. Furthermore, whites must have clear ideals which characterize white identity and strive to maintain them in everyday life, or whites shall not survive as distinct ethnic groups and members of a wider distinct race. Whites must maintain these ideals even if all whites do not share such characteristics. Only the recognition and elevation of an ideal can motivate a community to protect it, since the ideal becomes a symbol representing the identity of the people. If one is offended by the maintenance of the ideal, then that person obviously does not belong as part of the group. And then there's another paragraph after that. Well, you know, this might sound like just a lot of words as I read it, but I thought there was a great idea in there. And he is talking about that we have to have ideals. We have to have an ideal that maybe not everybody shares, but it's like it symbolizes who we are. This gets back to who we are. Who is us?
Yes.
We
yeah,
have to
is...
have this idea of who we are, and we need to, as he says, protect this ideal and try to maintain it in everyday life and keep it as you know in our mind and make it again our ideal. And
right.
Symbolizing, he says, representing the identity of us as a people. And I don't know what this would be exactly, but I think that's a good idea and very true.
Yeah, what I liked about it is that it gets into this issue of identity and ideals. And, you know, the conflict between Christian identity, and I'm speaking in general terms, not the entity Christian identity, but the identity, you know, when Christians have an identity as Christians and think of themselves as Christians first and identify with other Christians as their kin, in a sense, that is in conflict with a racial identity as a white person. And there are lots of people, anti-Christian people, who criticize Christianity because they say, you know, that takes precedence over their racial identity, and that's bad for whites, if, you know, just to put it in my own terms, I guess, my own understanding of it. And I would have to agree with that. But I think in this case, now maybe Bill is just trying to pull a fast one by in the way he's writing, but this is all about racial identity, really. He doesn't mention Christianity in here. Now, maybe that's one of the ideals that he's talking about. And some people, when it comes to identity and white identity, they think it's a purely biological thing. And I've tried to point out that it's also at least partly ideological, too. It is based on ideals. So that's what I like about this. He's very frank, and more frank than 99% of white people and maybe even most racialists, as far as how important a white identity is, and that is of prime importance, that people need to value that and need to then agree on what the ideals should be of the group. And you can't have a coherent group without coherent ideals. And that's where we then get into debates about, well, should our white group be Christian or not? Should we make that a requirement of people to be in our group or not? And that's where we can fraction or faction into separate nations and separate ethnicities as to, you know, whether we adhere to a particular religion as an ideal or whether we have different flavors of those different religions as we have in the past. And that was the difference amongst many of the European nationalities, was these differences of language and religion. And there was an underlying racial difference, too, amongst the people, as subtypes, sub-European mm-hmm. Racial strains.
Right. So, you know, I don't see, you know, he comes from a type of Christianity that is totally racial.
Yeah,
so
that's
exactly,
you know, what I said. I do see Christianity here in the article.
Yeah.
And he makes the point that earlier in the before the 1980s that white nationalists used to be called Christian patriots. And I've made several posts about this. I still don't know all the details of what's happened, but, you know, George Lincoln Rockwell used to try to appeal to people as white Christian Americans, and he always, mm-hmm. you know, emphasized the Christian part of that. And I think that was a cultural acknowledgement that most of the white people in America were Christian. That's one of the things, that's one of the ways he cleaved off the Jews. I mean, he was very explicit in excluding the Jews as well, but that's one way that you can put it in simple terms to somebody who's not all that knowledgeable about who the Jews are and what they are, is to just, you know, distinguish by saying, well, us Christians versus those Jews.
Well, yeah, and now Henry Ford does that a lot too, you know, in the International Jew. I mean, the term Christian, and in many people writing at that time, the term Christian is synonymous with white or Anglo-Saxon or something. You know, I mean, what they considered to be the white Americans, mostly in the area of Anglo-Saxon. Well, that time went by fast.
Yeah.
I'm not reading this correctly. Okay. Well, then I want to continue with this just a little bit or maybe I could finish it right now. But yeah, because in my mind, I can think of myself as a cultural Christian. I can defend Christianity, not in the sense of all of the, you know, all of the dogma or something, but in the sense of it's our cultural, it's religion. It's the religion of white people. And because, you know, people who want to go back to paganism, they don't like it and they, you know, think it's ruined everything. I just think that is just a, it's fine if they believe that, but I don't think they should ruin the whole movement for that reason. And, you know, we've got this thing that holds us together quite a bit, and there's no reason to be condemning it all the time. Well, I do want to say a little more when we get back. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Frank Reneke. Enjoy the music.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie keinen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Musik. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allem entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour on February 25th, 2013, and you're here with Carolyn Yeager, that's me, and Tan Stoffel, who you know from the White Network and Age of Treason blog at ageoftreason.blogspot.com. So, Tan, we're into some discussion here that's very difficult and does not there is no easy solutions for it. And yet, I don't really want to belabor this Christianity, anti-Christianity point, but I just thought that I wanted to point out that it seems like it might be really difficult. When we talk, we talk from this Bill Fink article about having an ideal that inspires us, that we hold up. Well, then you've got different, the Christians and those who really hate Christianity can't use the same ideal. We have to find some racial ideal or let people hold up their own ideal, so to speak. But if we use Christian, as I was saying is used to be done, in place of white, to really distinguish from Jews and other groups that have different religions, then that is not satisfactory to the people that really cannot relate to, don't want to relate to Christianity, as don't want to, think of our culture as Christian. So, this is nothing new, and this was going on in Germany under the Third Reich, but Hitler knew that he just wouldn't let one group or the other shut up the other group. He allowed both to go on, and somehow things moved along. But people today are kind of spoiled in this because the church has weakened so much. The Christian churches have weakened so much, and then we have this horrible Christian Zionism. So there's not a lot that is appealing. And this leads us possibly, you can say what you want about that, and then this leads us to this business with Pope Benedict. And yeah. This article.
Well, let me say in reaction to what you've said so far that I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other about Christianity, in favor of it or against it. I'm more willing to be educated, willing to be convinced by argument by this. And there have been some arguments that have been made that have convinced me. I do consider myself cultural Christian as well, that I was raised around Christianity. I know plenty of Christians that are good people. I feel sympathy for them that they're misled by some of the Christian beliefs. I liked what Will Williams, the point that he made, that the piece that he read from the National Alliance handbook about the attitude, the policy of the National Alliance toward Christianity, which was pretty hard line as far as, if you're going to have a Christian identity, you're not going to be part of this group. And I can understand that. It's to them, they saw it as important enough that it's like we see at the White Network, the Jewish issue is it excludes you. That's it. You can't be part of this. So That's how I feel about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, we have to find a solution to that. I don't know what it will be, but I think, you know, I'm most unhappy with the people who want to be so anti-Christian and attack Christianity in such a vile way that they do. And these are some people I like Will Williams. He does that too, you know, and say that, well, it was Jewish from the beginning. It's Jewish and we just can't have it. We got to get rid of it all. Well, let's take a look at this thing with Pope Benedict. I mean, I know the Catholic Church and hierarchy is in such bad repute with so many people. It seems now I am convinced. Now, and it's interesting that Gordon Duff came out on a radio program recently. He was with Jeff Rentz. And he said, oh, I know now, I heard, you know, this is the kind of intelligence he has. The reason that Pope Benedict is resigning is because he had found a file, the Holocaust file. He was going to release and expose the Holocaust, the Vatican Holocaust file, and that would show that the Holocaust didn't take place. I thought, well, I wouldn't believe anything that Gordon Duff says. Well, now it has come out for real that the reason is because there was uncovered for a year-long investigation that Benedict got some information about some things, and he asked these three cardinals to do an investigation, and they did it secretly, and it was just three of them, and they did a very good job, I guess, according to all reports, and they then gave a 300-page report at the end to the Pope, and there was only one copy of this report, and he has it, and he was so discouraged by it and felt that this was a huge problem in the church, and he was too old and didn't, you know, not up to dealing with it, and somebody younger and stronger or whatever, you know, needed to do it. And that's this, and I guess he was already considering resignation, but he probably was being talked out of it. But he decided that this is what he was going to do. And what this report says is not part of it. Because there are several problems, but part of it was a homosexual ring, they call it a crime ring. Well, I don't have the better article in front of me here, but that has been gotten so much power and is controlling so many things. And that and some other things that are in control in the Vatican, in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. And he was so discouraged. Depressed him so much. He doesn't, you know, I guess these are really, it's really hard to get at this because these are, you know, people who are probably instrumental in so many areas. So I don't know, but this, I absolutely do believe this because this Robert Moynihan wrote Inside, writes for Inside the Vatican magazine. I think he just does reports now, but I read a couple of his reports on it, and he was there in the Vatican talking to the people when this broke out in a newspaper in Italy. They are called La Repubblica. Newspaper came out with it. Somebody had leaked it to him, and it's a left-wing newspaper, center-left or something like that. Center-left is pretty far left in Europe, And so now they're dealing with this, and I guess the Pope is going to be, I don't know, he's any day now is his final day. So this is, you know, you wonder about how does this happen? You know, people say, well, they've already always been this way. I think that they're sincere people. I think Benedict is a sincere person. They're sincere Catholics who believe in everything and are trying to do the best, and then there's all this other stuff because it's such a big organization. But, you know, what would be if somebody might be, I'm getting a notice here. Let's see. Somebody's calling. All right. So I'm going to take this call. So why don't you respond to that, Tan?
Okay. Well, I read the article by Kevin Barrett that you had forwarded, but I otherwise haven't followed this Pope thing too closely, except to know that it's unprecedented in the last 500 years for a Pope to resign in this fashion. So I assume that there is some sort of scandal that will come to light. I don't know. I'm kind of skeptical as to what exactly the details are of the scandal because I don't think that the report has been made public yet. But some of the lines from this Kevin Barrett thing were interesting. I thought that he made the analogy that the church was suffering from something similar to the criminal banks that were too big to fail, that he said that this crime ring within the Vatican, within the church, was too big to fire, to overcome, that the Pope really was, his point was that the Pope wasn't powerful enough to put an end to it himself, that he wasn't really in control of the church. I don't, that's neither here nor there. But then he also quoted Michael Jones, who some white racialists may be familiar with. He's kind of a Christian identity kind of guy, with an identity.
Let me just break in a minute and ask if this person, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm online.
Okay. All right. I couldn't tell because, all right, go ahead, Tan. Yeah, just hold on.
Well, no. Let's let the caller speak and not keep them on the line too long.
Okay. All right. Well, what, can you give us your name and your, where are you from?
Yeah, this is, Stuart. I'm, calling from Florida.
Okay, Stuart.
Hi, Stuart.
Okay. I just, thank you for the quick response. You know, it's fine to talk about, you know, foundations of a movement. You know, I find that most of the people in this movement don't really plug into what's actually going on, what are really crisis situations. And in particular, I'm thinking about the gun issue.
Yeah.
Because there's a major push to get the guns. And if they get the guns, they come for the dissidents afterwards. And you're not going to be able to function openly. And so, you know, I think that it's a great weakness of this movement because they're coming for the guns, and there is organization going on. I don't want to just come on here and plug a website, but you know there are.
Oh, I know your militia website. Well, what do you mean by what do you think should be done? What do you think are what is not being done in the movement? You said this movement's not.
There's one of the blogs that I've been frequenting, and you know, there's a lot of discussions, theoretical, what's going on, and that's only part of what's needed to be done. But I don't see any initiative to intervene in what's actually going on, other than some theoretical discussions.
That's because there's no organization, and that was the other thing I wanted to talk about was that I didn't remember to add to my new page was organization and planning. That we really don't have any organization, and a good part of it is because you have people on all these different pages who are arguing with one another. Either it's the religion thing or it's the race thing, where they don't want to be, they disagree on who's white and what whites, who should we should ally with and so on. So without people being on the same page, you can't really get a good, strong organization. And I'm talking about a rather small organization that would be all on the same page, as we mentioned before, and would pick out targets and go about it, and also be working to be working with other people.
Stuart, are you saying that some of these militia people would be enlightened to hear an explanation that it's the Jews behind the gun grab?
Sure,
or are they already aware of it?
I could give you a website I've been listening to for a long time, and they provide a lot of information and political analysis, and they talk about that all the time.
Well, we don't want more websites. We want to hear from you. What is the answer?
Well, the answer is the formation of militia units with people that you know, okay? Not with strangers, people that you know, and to look where you can get training and information. And that's what's good about this website that I listen to. And, I mean, they have a tracker. They don't say, join us. No. They don't want to know anything about you because it's a security issue. You get together with people in your neighborhood. Now, for example, I mean, they're coming after the veterans now. It came out in the last week. And it also came out how they have the Homeland Security is buying targets with pregnant women and children. You know, they're looking for another Waco. And they mean business, and I hate to quit. Well, you have to prepare for these things because they're going to come for the dissidents afterwards.
Well, I agree. They've got plans, and we don't have any plan. And if we think they're just not doing anything, we're wrong because they are planning things. And so, but
right.
People aren't. why the militia seems to be not a popular thing anymore, where at one time it was really popular.
I think if you listen to the shows, that, you know, that this website, you get a different picture.
What's the website, Stuart? I'm curious.
Okay, well, it's libertytreeradio.4mg.com. Yeah. And if you listen, and, you know, you'll get
You have to. If you just look at the website, it looks like one of these places that are selling all kinds of survival stuff. It looks like nothing, you know, so you have to go to the right place, as Stuart says, and listen to his radio program.
Carolyn, have you listened to the show?
No.
Okay. Well,
I'm curious. I'd like to listen, Stuart, and I will.
And there's an archive section. You can listen to the archive section. They talk about everything from, all kinds of preparation to political analysis. And then they've had, trainings, and they've had people from different states coming up just in the last week. You know, and they do that periodically. And, you've got to, I can't say any more, but, I appreciate your giving me some time.
Thanks, Stuart.
Sure.
I agree with the sentiment. You know, there's this prepper movement too, which is sort of a related thing to the militia.
Yeah, but this is, they talk about you know where to get military supplies, military tactics. I mean, they were talking about what went on at Waco and in terms of military tactics, you know, things like that. And it's a cross section of a lot of things, and it's very useful information because the electoral process is basically closed off because of the computerized voting machines are highly fraudulent. They have, which is even worse than it's been before. So, that route is closed. So, what do you do? I think this is a solution.
Well, it would be if I don't know how you get people interested in that. I just don't know how that's.
No, I think Stuart's saying that a lot of people are interested in it, and we would benefit, I think, from connecting.
Yeah, I think give it a listen to, and I think you'll find it very useful.
Yeah.
Well, what can we? All right, so you're just wanting to recommend people go there and listen to that.
Listen to that. See how you can prepare, and try to find like-minded people because when they come for the guy down the street because he's a veteran, you know, and he want to take his guns or. They want to harass people for whatever reasons,
So is this the only way that we're going to stop the gun grab is to be ready to go to war with these people in a militia situation? Because militias do not have the firepower to resist what the government has.
Well, that's not true. You know, at Waco, the first wave that came in, all these, mostly women and older people, a couple of younger guys. They basically, destroyed the ATF when they came in the first time. Actually, they were just talking about it on the show tonight.
Yeah, but then they were stuck in that house, and then they had more coming. So, I mean, it didn't.
Yeah, well, there's been other instances where they were beaten back, but they're not as all-powerful. Look in Iraq where they don't have air superiority. And we're still in Iraq or Afghanistan, where we're leaving and with our tails between our legs. You know, these people, they're not high-tech societies. You know, they try to propagandize you into this idea that it's futile to resist, and it's not. And I think they give you a lot of information on that show that explains why.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you very much.
That is a big part of what the enemy does to us is to try and demoralize us.
Psychological warfare.
That's right. And convince us. I mean, that's the best, that's a Sun Tzu art of war type of bit of wisdom there about the best way to wage war is to not have to even fight, get your enemy to lay down his arms without even fighting him. Yeah. And that's what they're trying to do to us.
Well, I think we should expose how they go about this pushing this gun control. That's the way I do it. But rather than
strip their anonymity, identify them as Jews. Identify, give people the information that they need to connect who it is and why they're doing this and what's down the road for us. That these are the grandsons and granddaughters of the same people who ran the gulags in Bolshevist Russia. So
exactly, you know, Kapner had a good piece on something like Jews leading gun charge. It was very good.
Yeah.
check out his site. It's a good piece.
Okay, Stuart.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Thank you. See, he doesn't know that we don't want to watch Kapner.
Yeah. Well, it's yeah.
Well, you know, speaking about this, though, you know, I still think, and I haven't been able to check into what's going on lately, but I still think from the beginning of all my study of that, I'm convinced that this Sandy Hook was a psyop and that it wasn't at all what they say it was. And if you could expose these things, but most people think that you're going and you're just hopeless and they don't even believe it anyway. They think it was real too. So, you know, this is where to me the psychological warfare is in what they put on television.
Yeah. I've heard you discuss it with Hadding, and I'm more in agreement with Hadding that I haven't followed the story in detail, so I don't know.
Well, that's the trouble. Everybody who doesn't, who wants to, including Will Williams, wants to believe, that it was that this guy, Adam, actually went in there and did this.
It's not that I want to believe what the government tells me. It's that it really doesn't matter. You know, it's sort of like the same thing with Breivik. It's the same thing with 9/11. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there. And I hear all sorts of conflicting stories from different people who I have different levels of trust with. But the sense that I make of it is this, you know, don't let a good crisis go to waste kind of thing, that the government and the Jews and the government are using this as a pretext to push on the guns. This is, they see an opportunity here.
Well, I know you do. And that's what these people, that's what so many are saying. However,
so whether it was triggered deliberately or they're just reacting very quickly to it.
You say you can't know. If you were to look at all the evidence from the beginning, and it doesn't take that long, but I did spend some time on it. You would see that it's more than that. You can't just go along and say, "Oh, it happened," because it didn't happen. It's just like so many things. It's impossible what happened. What they say happened. It doesn't. It's impossible.
I'm already convinced my government is illegitimate and hostile to me and people like me. So I don't really need to be convinced that they could do something like that, or that they would do something like that, or that they're capable of doing something like that. So to me, it's kind of irrelevant. And that's why I don't object to you wanting to demonstrate this to people. If it convinces more people that the government is illegitimate and doesn't represent our best interests and is run by a hostile elite, then that's great. More people thinking along the right lines that see reality as it really is. And the point about what Stuart had to say about these militias and prepper types is I would hope that what we could offer them is some better understanding of what it is they're preparing for, what the enemy is capable of, how ruthless they are. And from them, I would hope to learn, you know, what is it that I can do to prepare? You know, what brand of beans should I buy? What brand of ammo should I buy? Things like that. So there can be a mutual exchange there with groups like that.
Well, see now, Tan, if you had another show or a different kind of show, you could talk to those people. Maybe they don't want to be. Well, they have their own programs, and maybe
they
don't.
Do. There's a lot of people doing a good job on that.
Okay.
Well, so much to get into. I have written a couple of blog posts that touch on it, and I've thought about a couple of others. The prepper movement is pretty interesting. It's the same pattern that you see over and over again. It's a sort of implicitly white movement of mostly white people, and they have some idea that something's wrong, but a lot of them deny it's about race, that it has anything to do with race, and so of course if they deny it's about race, they don't want to hear that it's about the Jews. But a lot of those people could be convinced because they're reacting to problems that are indeed racial in nature, and the Jews are causing and are on the other side, on the enemy's side, are the enemy. And so you can, the ones at least that can be reasoned with, you could reason with and reach.
Okay. And then, speaking about, how things happen, this kind of ties in, I think, with what we had gone into, and that is the business with the Pope resigning and his criminal rings in the Vatican, and one of which being homosexual. And they showed they had pictures of three top men in, and they're all so handsome, good looking. They looked like homosexuals. They did. I mean, you could just look at them and say, God, that's right. Yeah. I could say more about that, but I won't. How likely is it that this is going on purpose? That's not just something that developed, but that this has been set in there. Of course, they say the Jews have been infiltrating the Vatican for such a long time, but that this is all being done to finally bring down the Catholic Church.
Well, but there's a line from the Kevin Barrett article that reads, the cancer of criminality and sexual deviance in the Catholic Church is symptomatic of the growing decadence that afflicts Western civilization.
Well, that's Kevin Barrett.
He
hates Western civilization and Christianity because he's a Muslim.
Right. Well, he's at least, I think the diagnosis is correct there, that there is this decadence in Western civilization. It's the cause,
yeah,
the active ingredient
there
is the Jews.
Yeah.
You know, even a friend of mine, a close friend of mine who's doesn't like to think
about
it.
But you know, he doesn't want to talk about the Jews. He wants to talk about Bush.
Right.
The Bushes. He wants to talk about Republicans. He wants to talk about white Westerners and promote Islam all the time.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that he's coming from the right point of view at all.
No, he isn't. One of my recent posts, I made the point about these people who make sweeping explanations of what's going on that exclude the Jews, that don't talk about the Jews. Well, Kevin Barrett actually does, and that's what I was talking about. Michael Jones was talking about how sexuality has been weaponized by Zionists, you know, the code word for Jews. So he does at least indirectly talk about the Jewish influence that's behind a lot of this. I was going to say this friend of mine, who's another nobody, just a longtime friend, he's not trying to convince anybody of anything, but doesn't want to see it in terms of race. But even he could see that it seemed to be that there was this force in the government that wanted to break up families, that wanted to turn society inside out. Now, he sees it in terms of, well, they break up the families and that creates all sorts of problems, and then they can grow government and so they can tell, take over people's lives, and you know, it's just sort of a pointless. He gets the mechanics of it and the symptoms of it, but he doesn't see why somebody would be motivated to do that. The kind of animosity that racial differences can create, this hatred. And when you read what the Jews have to say, in contrast to the stories that people like to make up, and whether Kevin Barrett is guilty of this or not, I don't know. But, you know, you see a lot of these stories about what's going on, and they describe all the symptoms. And I'm talking about professional thinkers now putting out professional opinions that they're paid to produce that exculpate the Jews, that don't mention the Jews. They point to this problem and this problem and this cause and that cause, and it's not about the Jews. And they have to cover up – they're covering up for the Jews, transferring the blame somewhere else. But on the other hand, when you pay attention to what the Jews have to say – about reality and what's going on. They see it's entirely in terms of the Jews. And who are the Jews' enemies? It's Europeans. They hate Europeans. It's a visceral, long-term,
they don't hate the Middle Eastern peoples and the Arabs and so on the way they hate whites and Christians.
Yeah.
They don't. Yeah.
Yeah. And they tell themselves.
So there's something going on there. And then you have a lot of these white, allegedly white people who are always talking about how Islam is a better religion, is a stronger, moral codes and so on. They have better societies. And we should go more in that direction. And these are people who really attack Christianity, like Kevin Barrett. And see it as want to say it's decadent, it's finished, it's all over, and we should all go to Islam and let you know kind of all basically become Muslims because and then fight the Jews or something.
Right.
But I'm very very suspicious of this. Yeah, I would think.
Yeah.
I know you do. And so what is going on with that? You know, is this just people who have their own beliefs, or is there something more guiding all of that?
Well, I think it's a separate power base that the Muslims have a separate identity from the West. They do have an identity all to themselves about what's best for themselves. But the mistake is that it's an alien ideology. It's an alien religion. Right. So it's also wrapped up and involved with the Jews. And that they are not stronger. Islam is not any stronger than Christianity as far as resisting Jewish influence and ultimately being ruled by Jews. And what the Jews call the Jewish Golden Age in history was when they sort of co-ruled in Spain. Mm-hmm. Between 700 AD or so, when the Muslims first came into Spain and the Jews who were there switched sides and betrayed the Goths and worked with the Muslims and as I say, co-ruled and had a golden age there until 1492, when Isabella and Ferdinand finally reconquered Spain and took it back for Europeans. And this is part of the Jewish grievance against Europeans. But my point is that the Jews can coexist with Muslims just as well as they can with Christians, and that Islam does have some more radical believers that, in the same way Christianity does, that are more resistant to Jewish rule and Jewish influence. But throughout history, there are examples where they have been co-opted and they have been infiltrated by Jews in the same way that Christianity has. So, no, yeah, that's not going to be our solution. It's not a solution.
Well, yeah, I agree. And I don't
think racial identity is the solution.
That's right. We shouldn't be praising Islam and say they have a better system than we do. We should be accepting that our history is Christian and pre-Christian, and we should look into it and find out why it's all being torn apart and destroyed. We know that the Scofield Bible was absolutely written and by Jews, under Jewish direction and introduced and so on. And look how successful it's been in turning all, in being the Bible that all these Christian Zionists use. And yeah, the same thing is probably happening with the Catholic Church. And I think it would be it's going to be, while some people, I guess, would be, think it's a great thing and would be celebrating, I think it would be a terrible thing. Even though I don't like what they do, I don't like so much of it, but there's something about our civilization. You know, when that goes, they say, well, that's the whole Western civilization, which is now rotten and falling apart. They include it with that. And then most white people will say, after it's all done, well, yeah, our civilization was not good. It didn't stand up and it's all rot, was all rotten, and we're all rotten. And, this is just part of the whole demoralization, I think.
Yeah, the biggest flaw with white people is that we let Jews into our society, and that mistake was made hundreds of years ago. That is the fundamental mistake. And that we continue to mistake Jews as Europeans and accept them in our societies. And even the work you've been doing on the international Jew, Henry Ford's work, is wonderful. I'm thoroughly enjoying that. But it makes me cringe every so often when they're talking, very intelligent people writing very incisive analysis of what's going on. And then they reveal in a way that they don't even have the thought of excluding Jews from their society. Mm-hmm. They work under the premise that they have to share their society with Jews, and just they think they can put a lid on Jewish misbehavior somehow, or they can get the good Jews to rein in the bad Jews. And that shows a fundamental misunderstanding of Jewish nature, of how the Jews see things. And what the Jews are willing to tolerate. The Jews, even what I'm saying, I realize Jews cannot tolerate even being excluded. That sets them off.
Yeah.
They are aggressive to begin with, but the minute you say, hey, you're a Jew, you're not a European, you're not a German, you're not an American, you're a Jew, and that's who you identify with, mm-hmm. they go ballistic. That's enough. That you're enemy number one, and they want to destroy you the second you make that. And you could say it in the most friendly terms that you want. People have throughout history said, hey, basically we're two different types of people. You have your tribe, I have mine. We should go our own separate ways. No, they won't accept that. And that narrative of whites, Europeans, are not allowed to discriminate, not allowed to exclude, because that's racism, is that's at the heart of our problem, is because it's only white people that have accepted this idea that we're not allowed to discriminate ourselves from anyone else. We're not allowed to exclude from ourselves anyone else. Meanwhile, they exclude whoever they want. The Jews are the most exclusive group that you can imagine, and that's how they've survived for thousands of years as Jews, because they have been so exclusive. They have so concerned about marrying their Jewish sons and daughters to the daughters and sons of other Jews, even if they have to go to the other side of the earth to marry them off. And that's where they are better at this than we are. It helps that they are aware that there's a war. It helps that they think of us and realize that we are their enemy. It seems so unfriendly to us, but they see the reality. To live the way they want to live, which is amongst us, making their profits amongst us, they have to suppress any resistance that any of us put up to them ruling over us, to them getting their special privileges. And they do it in many ways that to us just seem alien and unthinkable. I mean, I wouldn't think that I should move to Israel, buy a newspaper so that I can and start pushing for programs that should be taught in Israeli schools about how Israeli or Jews throughout history have wronged Europeans and try and guilt trip them so that I can make a profit over there. I wouldn't even dream of doing that. But that's exactly what Jews do. Them from the minute they moved into the United States, just to take one small window of their history amongst us, they immediately started trying to influence what was being taught in our schools. It's not that they want to tell their own Jewish children how to look at the world and what to think and do. They do that, and they do it very well. But they also then arrogate to themselves this need to go out and tell everybody else that they should be worried about what's best for the Jews. And they do it in a very dishonest way. They don't do it in an upfront way of teaching us that in those terms openly. Instead, they conflate it with, we're going to teach everybody to live together in peace and harmony. And what they're really trying to do is just gain themselves what they need, the space that they need to do what they do, which is in their own best interest.
Now on your Age of Treason blog, the new entry there is just great. It's this article from some Jewish magazines, or two Jewish sources, books, reviews.
It's one magazine with two different articles. Yeah, an older one,
okay,
and a more recent one. Yeah,
yeah, and what it reveals is this, that they're talking among themselves and saying that that the problem for Jews is and always has been anti-Semitism from Europeans, and that, like,
right,
in a sense that it's never going to go away, and they have to overcome that in some way. I don't know. You can tell about that better. They have to, and of course, Holocaust denial is brought up, and that's a big thing for all of them. That means Holocaust denial is anti-Semitism, right?
Yeah, you want to read that little section there of that that comment, that email that fella sent to us? All right, he sent it to you, but
yeah,
put it on the chat there, because I think that that's a good introduction to what I can say about this.
Okay, this is some Jewish guy who, I just got this before the show, an email from him through my website. It said, he writes to me, the general aim of the Holocaust denial is to challenge and ridicule the history of Jewish suffering during the war. The deniers want to rehabilitate fascism by denying its past. Holocaust denial is the most extreme form of anti-Semitism, and it shows how the system of anti-Semitic thought functions. Holocaust denial is therefore a result of classical anti-Semitism. As Ken Stern, Jewish guy, writes in his book Anti-Semitism Today, quote, Holocaust denial is about Jews, not about Holocaust. This is from 2006. We can see through you, he writes to me. You do not fool us. You will lose your battle. We love freedom too much. Nazism, along with communism and socialism, are the great enemies of freedom lovers.
Yeah, there's the bullshit right at the end.
Yeah.
a couple of things about this very self-righteous attitude. He's convinced he's right and we are the enemy. And he's crystal clear on that. And I would agree with him on that. It's people like this are our enemies. I recognize his hatred and his desire to destroy us. And I would just say that he's not entirely honest here about the way he phrases this. You can see the way he sort of inverts reality. Everything is what he says about it all being all about the Jews. He's right. It's about the Jews. But then he dishonestly sort of flips it around as if it's some sort of magical, noxious hatred that comes out of us.
Well, you know, I never
Jews
deny
for no
this
reason whatsoever.
I never would say that he's not right about me being an anti-Semite. And when he says Holocaust denial is to challenge and ridicule the history of Jewish suffering during the war, well, he might look at it that way, but I do challenge the whole idea of Jewish suffering, and I do have to then resort to ridicule often about it. And I am an anti-Semite, and I became an anti-Semite because I realize now that you have to be against the entire race and get them away from us in order to, you know, I don't care if they exist, if they could somehow have these people exist and not be interfering with everybody else, which I don't know that that's possible. But anyway, that's
yes,
what we
for
want.
What I want, you know, he's trying to tell us what we want. I want to rehabilitate my race, my people, the people I share interests with, our knowledge and our understanding of those common interests, and I want us to work to organize and work toward those interests. And that's what we're not doing. That's our failing now. And I want us to recognize who is aggressing against us, and that's mostly Jews.
Well, you know, he says here, you know, they want to reinforce Jewish suffering. Jewish suffering is absolutely necessary for them, and make out that they believe it 100%, of course, that, you know, it really was true. And so they want to strengthen Jewish suffering, and we want to weaken Jewish suffering or not take into account Jewish suffering. We're concerned with ourselves, not with them.
Yeah, right. But that's the arrogance here, is that the Jews,
oh, it is.
It's all about him, and then he transfers it's projection in a way, projecting his own hatred and his own self-obsession onto the anti-Semites, who, you know, I don't like to use that term to describe myself for the same reason I wouldn't call myself mentally or morally deficient, because that's all that term really means to most people who use it or hear it. I understand the origins of the term, William Marr, and how he used it as, you know, any sensible person who's not a Jew would be opposed to Jewish rule. And that's the sense I see it in. The point about this post that I made here in mm-hmm. reference to what the Jews say amongst themselves about when they're Jews talking to Jews about Jewish interests is how revealing this is, that a white person, a European, reading this should understand this is Jews view us as an adversary, as an oppressor, as a, you know, they look at the long history among us as this completely one-sided, lopsided episode, one episode after another of us just for no reason whatsoever treating them badly. And it's unbelievable. It's I mean, even if you just try to look at it objectively, as if I don't even have a dog in this fight, I'm not white, I'm not Jewish, I'm nothing, it's absurd that it could be so one-sided. It's like somebody's made the analogy before about going into getting kicked out of every bar in town. You know, getting kicked out of one bar, okay, maybe it's the bar's fault, but you get kicked out of every bar in town, you know, the problem is you. And that's the point of that image that's on the post that I made, too, about this. You know, Jews, the way they tell the story is they've been kicked out of every nation in Europe. In fact, some of them more than one time over the course of 2,000 years. So across time and space, the Jews have been mistreated by the Europeans. And everyone but the Jews, according to the Jews, is the problem. All the different peoples throughout time and space are the ones. It's just so blatantly absurd. And I think that there's a deeper thing going on here. I mean, if they just started out, if they walked up to you and said, X's have been kicked out of every nation in history, the man on the street would say, well, there must be something wrong with the X's. But there is something magical about the Jews. There's more to it than just this surface technique that they're using. This is, it's a reflection really of their power. They can say such nonsensical things because they have political, financial, and media power, and people are afraid to challenge it. Even the people who are clued in, who do actually know that it's bullshit and challenge it, are afraid to challenge it because they're afraid to lose their job. They're afraid to lose their business or their wealth or their power or their social standing.
Well, let's bring up Charles Kraft now then, because once this crowd out there on the northwest coast of the United States, where he is and where he has his biggest reputation as an artist.
And, you know, he's in Seattle, I think.
Yeah. He has turned to ceramics and made a big name for himself, you know, in a small way. I mean, he's not a huge name in the art world, but he is in the regional art world. You know,
the description was that he's considered the greatest living artist in the Northwest, not just in Seattle, but the whole Northwest. So it is a big deal.
They said he was the greatest living artist in the Northwest.
Yeah, and in these critical articles about him, yeah.
Oh.
That's what drives the nuts about Charlie Kraft.
Yeah, well, so then he, you know, once they got a whiff, now we're talking about liberals, Jews, and homosexuals in this area very strongly, who want, you know, a very tolerant society, you know, for themselves. And now they got a whiff of him and his attitude toward Holocaust, and he might even be denying it, but he certainly questions it. And this was shocking. And now everybody changed their mind about how good his art is and whether he should be allowed to, anybody should buy it, and whether it should stay in the museums that it's in out there, and, you know, so on. So, this is how seriously these people take this. And it's more, he might be sympathetic to the National Socialism. But mostly they talk about the Holocaust, because that's just something that they cannot be. They want to be so liberal and so tolerant of differing views and personalities and, you know, lifestyles and so on among themselves. But if you're not one of them, and if it's something that they, you know, can't handle, then they're not tolerant at all. And I never saw such an intolerance taking place.
It wasn't just the Holocaust. It was also the fact that he had expressed some of these opinions on the White Network, on you know, whites talking to whites about white interests.
Was
quoted in every one of these articles, because apparently, you know, to them that's some sort of damning thing to be associated with white people who see themselves as white and are talking about white political interests.
On July 28, 2012, he participated in a podcast produced by the white nationalist website, The White Network, whose tagline is "Whites Talking to Whites About White Interests." According to the White Network About page, and then they quoted our whole about thing, what we believe in, which is nice. Yep. And then they said that what he said on this podcast, and you know, I had Charles on, I think, three shows. And before he ever went on Counter Currents, where they talked about his art mainly. And Charlie has agreed to come on my Saturday show coming up. And I think that's real brave of him, and I hope he still does. We're not meaning to stop that by bringing it up here. But you wanted to discuss it in terms of the kind of work you're trying to do on your programs.
Well, the White Network, the work we do with the White Network. I mean, talking about the White Network in this this program here, this is a big thing. This happened just a week or 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it's major media exposure. It was in a local Seattle paper called The Stranger, and also in the Huffington Post. And one point I want to get across here is that especially at this Stranger magazine or newspaper, you know, this is the sort of people who anything goes. These are the type of liberals where anything goes, and you've made that point. But, of course, anything goes except whites talking to whites about white interests, and they're irreverent about everything. They thumb their nose at everything of traditional or anything that's based on rules or norms, except the Jews, except when it comes to the Jews. And the idea that Jews aren't white, that Jews are aggressing against whites, that the Holocaust is a hoax, that they, you know, wildly exaggerate it for their own political gains. This is just considered, you know, sacrosanct. You can't do that. That's that's what's so funny about these people acting so offended, and their minds are blown. Their heads have exploded. They really have nothing that they can say to Charlie except to defriend him, to say, you know, how surprised they are and how horrible this is. It ties into a theme that I've identified early on in my series of podcasts that I call Stupid, Crazy, Evil. And that's one of the ways that they attack us when we try to speak up in our own defense. Is the first way they do it is they try to dismiss us as stupid. They try to make us think that even speaking in our own interest is just stupid. It's only something that, you know, those dumb skinheads do, and really intelligent people don't even think about such things. So you shouldn't think about it. Otherwise, we're going to call you stupid. And if you get past that, well, then they call you crazy, and you must be insane. Now, neither one of these things applies to Charlie Kraft. He's a genius. That's another word that came up. The greatest artist in the Northwest, a genius. He's not stupid. He's obviously not crazy. So what do they go to? The third and final catch-all, which is he's evil, or at least the ideas that he's playing around with are evil. They're incomprehensible. They're grounds for just defriending him. They're grounds for not even bothering to talk to him about mm-hmm. what he thinks or why he thinks it. We don't want to hear it. We've just got to disconnect from him. No matter how much of a genius we think he is, no matter how much of a great artist he is, he's just ruined it all. He's done it to himself. And, you know, we're going to help him by slamming the door in his face. And, you know, good riddance to those people. I mean, I don't know. That's how I would think about friends who say that sort of thing to me. It's like, no, you can't slam the door on me. I'm going to slam it on you if you feel that way. You never were a friend, I guess, if you misunderstand mm-hmm. in that way.
Yeah, here's one paragraph towards the end of this article. It says, maybe that this woman is just wringing her hands over this, you know. She says, maybe what's hardest to accept is that a man so totally, radically, fist-pumpingly opposed to ideology, a guy you wanted to root for at the end of a bloody, painfully ideological century, himself seems to have succumbed to an ideology. Do they think they're not part of an ideology?
No, they don't. And they think that what we're doing is stupid and crazy. That's that it's an ideology that we just adhere to for no good reason. They can't fathom it. They can't understand it. I can understand why they think the way they do, because it feels good, and because it, you know, fitting in with all of the other people who are making the same posturing about what great people they are and how noble and honorable they are. But they're deluded. And the point that comes up in one of the articles, and I think this actually might have been Greg Johnson's point, is that Charlie really, he's like a lot of liberals, but he's woken up to the fact that the changes, this race blindness and so forth and the open borders is going to destroy even the liberal society, even this anything goes liberal society, and that there are going to be more people like this, I think, that are waking up to it. Because it's the reality. The reality is that this liberal idea is a fatal, poisonous idea that destroys itself. It destroys the people that espouse it.
Mm-hmm.
Not the people who espouse it falsely, like Jews do, where they want everybody else to be open and allow anyone into their country. Meanwhile, they have their own narrow interests in mind, their own narrow identity that they jealously guard. And, you know, they tell their sons and daughters to marry other Jews and, you know, keep their group integrity, and they can even operate amongst bigger majorities that way. But they want everybody else, and in that way, their liberalism isn't the same as white liberalism. Their liberalism is with their own self-interest in mind, whereas white liberals are deluded. They think it's for everybody's benefit, and it is for everybody's benefit, everybody but theirs, and it will eventually destroy itself. It will destroy the white liberals. My problem with it, I wouldn't mind if they just wanted to jump off a cliff themselves. The problem is that they're taking me and my family and everyone I care about down the drain, too.
Yeah, they're horrible. I think they're horrible. But then they think, you know, I'm horrible and people like me. So there we we have this another huge division. But now Charlie has kind of has bridged this. He said it was in 2000 that he discovered this, got interested in this case about a Romanian archbishop who was deported from the United States where he had become a citizen and sent back to Romania over some kind of, you know, a trumped up charges of Nazism during wartime. And he got real interested, and he was just researching this, and then it opened up to all kinds of things, including white nationalism. And he discovered Kevin MacDonald, and he read his books, and then that went into more things. He got into the Holocaust, and, you know, one thing led to another, and he was not able to stop. He didn't want to stop. So we can hope that that's an example of more people. But the way these people's reaction, as you said, is just shocking. You know, they're just amazingly dense about it all. Let's see here. I'm going to look for. You know, I don't. Did we leave something out, Dan?
Yeah, we were going to talk about future direction. What we were going to.
Oh,
we're planning
okay.
On
all right. Well, you only got a couple minutes, so. Well, why don't you start with that?
Okay. I'm going to continue on this race fraud idea, you know, how basically we've been defrauded to abandon our racial identity as whites. And there's several more examples that I have in the pipeline here going forward. I intend to get back to more science and less anthropology, less narrative, and specifically DNA. I want to talk about the genetic basis of whites and our differences. And the evidence for the Aryan conquests and the mixture of genes within Europe. And then I want to get into Jewish identity. And that's a very, very broad topic. Lots of things to talk about there. I've talked about bits and pieces of it leading up to in all along that I've been going on. But I want to go into great detail in that and distinguish them from whites, both ideologically and genetically.
Okay,
and I also
we're not hearing the. We've got 30 seconds. We're not hearing the prompt.
Must be because of the call. Yeah,
yeah, right. So you continue.
And well, psychology is another big thing. I think it's an important thing, especially mass psychology, mass marketing. This is part of a big part of the tricks that have been used to defraud us is these psychological tricks.
Okay, and for that, you have something to look forward to, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you so much, Tan Stoffel. I'm sorry for my messed up beginning of this program. And I thank you all for listening, and come back again. This is Carolyn Yeager for the Heretics Hour. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.